Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Asian American and Asian Research Institute Friday evening lecture series. We're also known as ARI. I'm John Chin, the interim dean of the institute. Thanks for joining us in person and online for tonight's talk on the current exhibition. It's called Legacies, Asian American Art Movements in New York City, 1969 to 2001. And we have with us tonight co-curator Professor Janie Cole Southard. Professor Southard is a contemporary art historian and curator specializing in contemporary Chinese art within a transnational context. She currently serves as a doctoral lecturer at City College, which is part of CUNY. She teaches arts writing and art history and has previously taught at the University of Oregon and the Hangzhou Academy of Art. With extensive curatorial experience, Professor Southard has worked at institutions like the Shanghai Museum and the Walker Art Center, and this current exhibition, Legacies, is at NYU's ADWSE. Is that how you say it? WSE? Okay. All right. She holds a PhD in the history of art and architecture from the University of Oregon, an MA from the University of St. Thomas in Minnesota, and a BA in International Studies from Luther College. So please welcome Professor Janie Cole Southard.
Thank you so much on behalf of me and my co-curators, Howie Chen and Christina Ong, for inviting us to be a part of this lecture series. And I'd like to give a special thank you to the artists that are online, and then one of which is with us today, Nina Kuo. Thank you for being part of this project and for supporting us throughout this show's tenure and beyond and before and all of those things. My name is Janie Cole Southard. I'm a lecturer at City College, teach art history, also the co-curator of Legacies, Asian American Art Movements in New York City, 1969 to 2001, which is open until next Friday at NYU's 80 Washington Square East. So the talk that I've prepared today is essentially a virtual overview of the exhibition, as well as I'm going to try and offer some insight into the curatorial decisions that we made and discussions we had throughout this process, which was, you know, extends well beyond the show's tenure. And again, thank you for having us here. So Legacies, Asian American Art Movements in New York City, is an expansive survey of rarely seen artwork and archival materials by artists that constitute and exceed Asian American, which is a label denoting a cultural and national identity invented in 1968. Utilizing an interdisciplinary and research-driven praxis, Legacies uncovers how artists of Asian descent have historically negotiated identity in America as a set of situated practices and institutional structures amidst transnational diasporas, racial phantasms, and political imaginaries. Legacies is the first institutional survey exhibition that focuses exclusively on artists of Asian descent who are based in New York City. I'd like to next explain the title of the show. When our team first conceived of the exhibition, we originally titled it and applied to the Tiger Foundation with the title Legacies, Asian American Art Movement on the East Coast, 1969 to 2001. But as we curated the objects that kind of resulted in our list for the show, we added the S to movements. So it's Legacies, Asian American Art Movements, to better support our thesis that Asian American art is reflective of multiplicity, and there are a lot of different definitions rather than singularly defined. And informed by these scholarly explorations of racial identity, we did want to note that this kind of term, Asian American, that emerged from real activist and historical discourse from the Bay Area. So our initial titling of On the East Coast aimed to kind of contextualize the development of Asian American identity in the late 1960s beyond the Bay Area to account for local specificities. However, and again, as we collected objects objects and we consulted our network of artists that we eventually included, we noted that almost everyone was affiliated or lived in New York City, and we were picking artworks that really centered New York. So instead of speaking to the East Coast broadly, we decided to intentionally highlight New York in the title as our key site of interrogation, interruption, and also as an art historian, this really directly for me challenged the idea of New York City's artistic capital, which I thought was really important. So thus the title, Legacies, Asian American Art Movements with an S, in New York City specifically, that emerged from those discussions. And this is one example of themes and different kind of ideas that we tackled throughout this. So for further background, Asian American, that idea or label, it's now a commonplace demographic label. It was first employed, as I mentioned, in 1968 by UC Berkeley's Asian American Political Alliance as a progressive political identity, invoking a coalitional politic necessary for the Third World Liberation Front student strikes in the San Francisco Bay Area. Asian American artists and organizations in New York engaged regularly with their West Coast counterparts. Some even attended school in the Bay Area and brought that ethos kind of directly to places like Chinatown in New York, for example. So these artists in New York were taking inspiration from this idea of third world internationalism, the Black Power movement, the Chicano movement, and the anti-war labor and feminist movements, all linked to this kind of discussion and rhetoric coming out of the Bay Area to link political struggle with art and serve their respective communities in New York. So essentially, they were taking this discourse, applying it to New York. So Legacies expands on this, and we wanted to offer a broader understanding of the term's significance and contradictions within art to show that not only are artists responding kind of directly to the activist sentiments of this term, but responding in a variety of different ways. To ground our thinking, Legacies constellated three key artistic collectives and organizations, which the three of us, identified and have been working with individually for years, kind of before this exhibition came to fruition. So Godzilla, Asian American Art Network, the Basement Workshop, and the Asian American Art Center. All organizations were artistic, social, and political hubs for diasporic Asian artists in New York that intersected with other marginalized communities. Recognizing that identity-based categories of art are bound to kind of the dominant racial ideology and political narrative of a nation, the exhibition that we wanted to instead was trying, we wanted to focus on the multiplicity of these subjectivities and artistic expressions to interrogate life in America. Our team also really wanted to challenge curatorial methods. We were essentially trying to make an identity-based show that challenged this idea of identity. We always joked it was a non-identity identity show. So in order to do that, we wanted to look beyond traditional curating and approach it from an interdisciplinary perspective. So we had a kind of radically interdisciplinary team. Howie Chen's a curator. He's a director at ADOWSE. Myself, I'm a contemporary art historian, and then Christina Ong, who's a sociologist. And what we tried to do is we wanted to celebrate how each of us have cultivated this kind of unprecedented access to artists, archival material, and artwork, and historical narratives from this time through our own research. And we also wanted to bring together our own disciplinary perspectives. All of us, in addition to being from different fields, we all approach our fields very differently. So we wanted to highlight that as well. So we borrowed from each other and we learned from each other to create this methodological framework for an identity-based exhibition practice. The three of us met just while researching. My embarrassing fun fact is I emailed Howie kind of out of the blue after his book on Godzilla was published because I liked it. And we were able to connect via that. Christina and I and Howie and I have also been engaging with kind of similar artists and materials. And so it was kind of a natural, group to form from this. Just we knew of each other and were able to finally come together with this project. I think one of the most notable things for me, because it was my first kind of foray into sociology, was that we really leaned on Christina to help us to understand how do we kind of situate identity in, this artistic capital. So we tried and learned and read a lot about situated identity theory, which is a framework, a sociological framework that suggests that people take on different identities or roles or even behaviors and traits in different social and cultural situations. So for us, what it did was it allowed us to broadly define Asian American art to suggest that because, you know, these artists were all operating in New York, there was some awareness of this debate kind of going on. So even if an artist didn't necessarily respond the same way as another one or resisted it even, we could still kind of situate them within this framework because of these kind of broader cultural understandings that were going on. So here is the list of all 94 artists that we did select, and we, of course, could have had an expansive list. We could have gone farther and added more. This is real work. We intentionally don't have a kind of list of the artists at the exhibition, and I can explain why. So you'll see it here. But working within our consolidating groups, so the Godzilla Asian American Arts Center and Basement Workshop, and then also the kind of the networks that expanded from those, we selected these 94 artists. Our goal and why we don't have the list at the exhibition was not to make this a roll call show. We also didn't want it to be like a best of. That wasn't our goal. We simply, or maybe it's not so simple, but we instead wanted to select artists that we felt demonstrated our thesis of Asian American art as being kind of having more than one identity. And we also wanted to pick artists that responded to related thematic concerns, you know, such as the AIDS crisis or other kind of international politics. Additionally, for our show, we wanted like some deep cuts. So we wanted works that were rarely seen. So even, you know, if it's an artist that is perhaps recognized more than some others, we wanted to show work that was not necessarily the most obvious examples. So we worked directly with the artists, which is different than a lot of shows, to find pieces that we both, and we being the curators and the artists, highlighted this kind of theoretical focus that we wanted to make, also fitting that temporal framework for the show. So here, this is the gallery. This is an overview of the gallery. We had 5 rooms to work with, which at the start of this project seemed huge. When we started cultivating artists, seemed incredibly small. When we picked the artworks, felt impossible, and somehow we got everything in there. So that was kind of miraculous for us. The show is organized largely chronologically. I'm like, I think we got here. So it starts. This is kind of the entrance here. We walk in, the 1970s are here, going into the 80s and then the 90s. We did that to offer some kind of continuity, so there was a kind of narrative there. And then for those interested or who have curated before, how we designed the exhibition, or how we have John here, and the designer, he's the one that designed it, he's brilliant. But he put all the works in this digital dollhouse, which you're seeing here, and we worked to kind of arrange the works on the wall, like in each room, digitally. So back kind of before programs like this, people would make kind of physical dollhouses to replicate the gallery. Now that we're in 2024, we have a digital version, but it was fascinating and really fun to discuss with John and work with him to put the artworks together that we felt make sense. And also, you know, he's got this skill set that, you know, I learned a lot from him about just how to put things on the wall together and make it happen. So this is what it looks like before you put things on the wall, which is really fun. So overview of the gallery here. So now I'm going to kind of virtually walk you through the exhibition. So if you've seen it already, thank you so much for coming. And hopefully this is offering a little bit of a new insight. I think every time I give a tour, I do it differently because there's so much material to work with. So we're going to highlight some of the works. I'm not going to highlight all. There's over 100, right? There's 94 artists and over 100 works. I won't do that to you all, but we'll highlight some of them here. So legacies, what you see when you enter into the gallery space is our, you know, the marker here marking the show, and this piece by David Diao. And we really felt that this was a great piece to start with. This is titled Odd Man Out. One thing that really surprised me as a curator and in curating this exhibition, and coming from an art history perspective where I'm primarily working on writing and teaching and reading, right, it was seeing the works kind of all together and seeing that kind of visual narrative pan out. It shocked me. I was so surprised when everything came together. And one thing that was really striking to me is how these artworks mapped onto the contemporary art canon and also kind of resisted it. So it's a really compelling, at least for me, visual narrative that kind of emerged from this. And this one, I think, is perfectly kind of encapsulates that sentiment for me. So this piece, it adopts the language of abstraction, which was something that was dominant in the art market in the late 60s and the 70s. Many artists, including marginalized artists, noted this trend and kind of felt pushed or forced to make work in this aesthetic and using this kind of aesthetic language to achieve commercial success. So David Diao, he's an artist who's had a career spanning over 5 decades, and he kind of critically explores key tenets of modernism in painting, kind of while using the language of kind of the dominant art market. So for this piece, Odd Man Out, he was engaging with these motifs in the history of abstraction, and his work kind of tries to destabilize these formalist traditions and underpin this history with a focus on his biography and social issues of the time. So Odd Man Out obliquely kind of reference a film and novel of the same name and breaks the convention of titling abstract paintings untitled, which for those of us that are familiar with art, that is kind of what you do. The reason that an artist would not title an abstract painting was to place further emphasis on the form, right? So this was kind of a radical move to not only title it, but also kind of reference this critique that many artists, that they felt compelled to make this type of work. So as we move forward here, a reminder again that I'm not going to look through all the selections, but just highlighting a few. This background information is hopefully going to understand or help us to understand or help to elucidate some of our thinking of this expansiveness of this idea of Asian American art. Curatorially, we also kind of took lead for each decade, though everyone had inclusions in every single room, and we talked about every single piece. So the returning to the Diao, that's kind of accompanied by a piece by Leo Amino, Noguchi, Kazuka Miyamoto, Namjoon Paik, Yoko Ono, Yayoi Kusama, and Ching-Ho Chung. These artists were active in the art world in the 1970s. You might even recognize some of those names, though they were also subject to race-based discrimination. Again, and this is an example of where we were kind of adopting that situated identity theory to put these artists in connection with those with more activist leaning, which you'll see in a minute. And we wanted to include these artists alongside these artistic kind of reflections from the community movements to really support this other kind of idea of locality as well. So one kind of just interesting anecdote related to the Noguchi that I didn't know was that after he purchased a photo printing plant in Long Island City in 1974, which was across from his studio, Noguchi transformed the site to become the Noguchi Museum, which still exists today. But one kind of interesting thing was that it was the first monographic museum established by a living artist in the United States, which I thought was very interesting, and I had no idea until we were working with the museum with that piece. So in this gallery, kind of on oppositional walls from those works I just showed, we have a selection of posters here from the artists in Basement Workshop. The Basement Workshop was a political and arts organization operating on the East Coast of the United States, primarily in New York City, but eventually did expand a little bit. It was formally founded in 1970, and Basement kind of began as a grassroots social services initiative created by Columbia graduate student Danny N.T. Young. There's a focus on serving Manhattan Chinatown's residents, primarily. The sentiments of this group were influenced by the movement for ethnic studies, Black power, and the struggle for Puerto Rican independence and the anti-war movement. And Basement, as a location, there was a physical site, shifted a little bit throughout the 10 tenure, but became a central place for young Asian Americans to explore their interests and expand their political horizons. Into the early 1970s, Basement's members developed a myriad of visual arts, music, dance, and theater programs and performances, many of which were guided by these kind of radical leftist politics and the principle "serve the people." Basement's rapid expansion led to a division in the arts and social services programming, with different arms of the organization running in various spaces throughout Manhattan's Chinatown. In its early years, there was a heavy priority, for example, given to programs related to political and community organization. And as the organization's leadership and membership shifted into the 1980s, so did the focus. And under longtime member and director Fei Chang, Basement reframed their work to uplift and support Asian American artists as well, hosting solo exhibitions at their gallery space and running a poetry and writing workshops. Basement closed in 1986, but left behind this interconnected network of Asian American artists that we will see throughout the rest of the show. And one thing I'll note here is that the dates of this exhibition, 1969 to 2001, it's delineating the start of Basement Workshop and the end of Godzilla Asian American Art Network. Asian American Art Center became a site for activity in 86 and is still ongoing, but that's kind of the years, so that's why the years are as such. So Basement is the kind of start of that. So when we're thinking about how to represent Basement, we wanted to represent them with a poster. Silkscreen posters were, printed posters were commonplace in the 1970s, often used in demonstrations and political protests. As a political and art-centered organization, members of the Basement Workshop held silkscreen printing workshops and designed their own prints in order to advertise Basement's programs or to bring them to protests and marches around the city. Though not necessarily conceived of as art, at least by the group at first or even kind of in public, these posters were designed to send specific political messages. And as Basement kind of developed its art focus in the late 1970s, the poster printing became kind of a tool for art making with kind of more intentionality than just using them for activist reasons. So Basement Workshop was really multifaceted. It's a hard and difficult thing to capture with just one work. So there's kind of a number of works that speak to this organization. Christina Ong is an expert on the Basement Workshop, so she really taught a lot to our team about this. So Basement Workshop's members participated in a number of different arts-based projects around the city. For example, in the 1960s and 70s, neighborhoods across New York City engaged in mural projects led by activists. So there were other kind of groups like Basement Workshop that were kind of interested in the same things. So City Arts Workshop is what it was called. It was established in 1971, hired local artists to create murals by and for communities of color around the city. In the Lower East Side and Chinatown neighborhoods, Asian American artists and Basement affiliates Alan Okada and Tomia Arai were tapped to oversee the mural projects there, which we represented with an original mock-up of the eventual mural that was put up on, finished in 1974 on Madison Street. Okay. So we're going to go here. So in the first gallery, there's also a selection of archival materials, including a flyer from the 1979 Basement Workshop affiliated exhibition, Images from a Neglected Past, The Work and Culture of the Chinese in America. This brochure, it's right down here, displayed, depicts an illustrated timeline of major historical events, instances of racial violence, and accomplishments of Chinese Americans and Chinese migrants from 1839 to 1978. Importantly, this brochure is translated into Chinese, as Basement was really, even as the focus shift to art as well, always endeavored to have their programming be accessible to the communities that they were a part of. So I'm going to return to the works that we started with. So one thing I hope is coming clear is you already see kind of the variety of ways that artists were visually responding to these ideas of Asian American identity. So next, we're going to go to the 80s. So this was the age of early globalization and innovations such as the 24-hour news cycle. So we see artists engaging with international politics and events with experimental mediums, while also engaging in celebrating spaces like Chinatown via art. This room constellates around the Asian American Art Center, just as the last room kind of constellated around Basement Workshop. And many of the artists included in this gallery and Gallery 2 and 3 exhibited in at the Asian American Art Center. This room also really explicitly introduced the idea of diaspora. So, for example, this gallery features two works by Epoxy Art Group, which was a group founded by Hong Kongese artists who were working in the Lower East or in Lower Manhattan. And their name, Epoxy, was chosen to represent the hypothetical gluing of their cultures and experiences via art. Presented is up here is an archival adaptation of a slideshow titled Erotica. And this was an ephemeral performance at Red Spot Outdoor Slide Theater. The what we have reflected here, which is a digitized version of some of the original slides that we got from Ming Fei, one of the artists in Epoxy, serves as a historical reflection of the 1989 event. In the original display of Erotica, there was a projector kind of perched from a loft apartment across the street. The loft belonged to Red Spot, who was an artist working in Soho at the time to organize these kind of slideshow exhibitions where he'd put this, the projector in his window and then project the images onto a building. So it was originally, Erotica was originally accompanied by a score from Andrew Culver, who worked with John Cage, that played over a radio station that they kind of like rigged up. Erotica then was like projected onto this building. So the way that you would experience it is simply by walking through and around the neighborhood. This was in lieu of a formal gallery, which Epoxy was kind of refuted from representation by some of the major spaces. So it was a way to kind of negotiate with that by, you know, virtually positioning themselves into New York City's artistic climate. And featured alongside alongside Erotica is a previously unseen sample selection from Epoxy's 36 Tactics. And this is another artwork that the collective made. 36 Tactics was a collection of 36, go figure, Xerox copies based on the Chinese military treatise, The Art of War by Sun Tzu. Epoxy revisited the 5th century BCE text to offer their own contemporary interpretations of the military messages that spoke to rising internationalism and global politics in the 1980s. The resulting images were really sardonic, and they were responding to their own positionality as being Hong Kongers in New York, responded to the global Cold War, the Mao regime, Sino-American relations, kind of things related to their concern. The use of this kind of material, the Xerox, also conveys their international sentiments, kind of reflects this conflation of local and global artistic production. The Xerox was a really popular art medium in downtown New York at this time. So we see the image here. It's the drafted version with Reagan here. It says the text is Fool Heaven, Sail Sea. 36 Tactics is significant as well. It showed internationally at three institutions as part of Out of Context exhibition in Hong Kong in 1987, at Sabrina Fong Gallery in 1988 in New York. And lastly, it was part of the New Museum's Decade Show in 1990. And the Decade Show is pretty significant. It featured 100 artists across multiple institutions and is largely cited as the first exhibition in contemporary American art history to really center multiculturalism in the United States. So us getting this kind of essentially draft for a work that was then shown at this this exhibition that was really important to art history was really special for us. So amidst these kind of international sentiments, the gallery looks at Chinatown. So for example, we have an image by self-taught photographer Corky Lee, who was known for photographing Chinatown and other community events. Lee was a fixture in the Asian American cultural and historical movement across New York City, and he documented the community in order to combat mainstream media representations. Much of his work is read or interpreted as being journalistic in nature, but this piece is interesting because the three girls in the bathroom, it was a staged photo, so this was different than his more documentary style of photographs, whereas Lee positioned the women in the frame before he took it, so it was an intentionally staged photo. And it was shown at an exhibition at Pearl River Mart a couple years ago, and the three women in the show were able to, or in the photograph, were able to come together and like restage the photo again. It was really special. The gallery features artists who are also working outside of Chinatown, outside of this community network. Chen Kuangqi was part of the East Village scene, where he worked alongside artists like Keith Haring, who's Keith Haring's one of, close friends, and photographed many of his works. Chang's own photography practice reflected on his experience as a diasporic artist. He was born in Hong Kong, and his family moved to Canada when he was a teenager. And while he was a student, Chang took up photography, where he later saw the potential of the medium as an avenue for performative identity formation. In his East Meets West series, Chang wore a Mao suit, which you're seeing here, and sunglasses, pictured here, and photographed himself at famous tourist sites across the United States and later the world. Chang was able to capture these photos via an often visible cord, which resulted in some of the first selfies. So that's kind of fun. So returning to the idea of diaspora, we also wanted to include artists who engaged with New York's Asian American art movement, but that scholarship doesn't really recognize as that being kind of a part of their career. So Ai Weiwei is one of those artists. He showed at the Asian American Art Center, for example. And now today he's one of, one of the most recognized contemporary artists. He also, in addition to showing at the Asian American Art Center, he lived in an apartment in New York's East Village from 1983 to 1993. And during that time, he took over 10,000 photographs that documented his life as an artist and his artistic community. Photographs include scenes from New York City, social gatherings, self-portraits, his social circle, which included people like Allen Ginsberg, Xu Bing, and Wang Kunping, so among others. But these photographs we felt were really important, and we wanted to also include that in the show. So I keep talking about the Asian American Art Center. What is it, right? So the Asian American Art Center was founded as the Asian American Dance Workshop in 1974 by Eleanor Young and her brother Danny N.T. Young. You'll recognize that name as Danny being one of the founders of Basement Workshop. The siblings were both integral members to the Basement Workshop, but under Eleanor's vision, the Asian American Dance Theater celebrated and promoted Asian American dance through original productions and educational classes in New York City's Chinatown until 1990. In 1990, Young and her husband, Robert Lee, changed the name to better encompass a growing interest in the visual arts, so renamed it as the Asian American Arts Center. And it was one of the first organizations in the country devoted exclusively to Asian American art. And the goals of the AAC were to promote Asian American artists and their work through community-oriented events and exhibitions. Lee served and continues to serve as curator and director of the Asian American Arts Center, and his curatorial approach, often creatively pointed to folk art influences within Asian American art. So this is, an example of one, version of what Asian American art could be. Additionally, Lee centered politically engaged exhibitions that spoke to the featured artists' concerns. At its height, the Asian American Art Center held upwards of 4 exhibitions and multiple programs per year, which is quite substantial for a smaller nonprofit organization. Notable exhibitions include China June 4th, and He Was Looking for Asia, Alternatives to the Story of Christopher Columbus Today, and Eviction Blues. Today, the Asian American Art Center collection, which is overseen by Think Chinatown, contains over 300 works of Asian American art alongside a robust collection of folk art. The selections in this gallery in particular kind of reflect the history of this organization, and many works are borrowed from that collection. So moving to the next gallery, we see two artists who did also exhibit at the Asian American Art Center, Ming Fei and Arlen Huang. Arlen Huang's piece is right here. He also founded Squid Frames, and they helped us to frame the entire show. So it was really fun to work with him in that capacity as well. Arlen is an abstract painter who's known for his large-scale works inspired by the world around him. This piece here, it's titled Let's Do It, Let's Fall in Love, depicts Philip Ahn and Anime Wong from the 1937 American crime film Daughters of Shanghai. And this one is kind of fun because if we walk through the gallery, you can see Anime Wong like peeking out from Gallery 1, which is kind of fun. The film, which is well regarded as a successful B-movie, was notable for its Asian-focused theme and for featuring two prominent Asian-American performers as leads. This celebratory image, complete with pink hearts, can be read as a stance against the racism in Hollywood. So on the ground here, Ming Fei, and this is an entirely different work, is a sculptor whose work includes botanical elements to explore the relationship between humans and nature. Often his sculptures take form as hybrid oversized plants and seeds, such as anise, which we see here. These two are radically different works, aesthetically and even conceptually, but there's an interesting kind of juxtaposition between the pop aesthetics and the kind of spiritual motifs that felt very 80s to us, which was fun. And this is the other side of the gallery. It highlights the Asian American Art Center's exhibition China June 4th, which the Asian American Art Center staged in protest of the Tiananmen Square massacre in Beijing. China June 4th debuted at the center in 1989 and later traveled to the Blue Hellman Warehouse and PS1 before it was part of MoMA. The exhibition featured over 280 artists, many of which were Asian American artists, but some, were just artists in the New York community in its initial showings. And one of those artists was Anna Kuo. So that's here. Anna Kuo's painting meditated on a metaphysical experience in response to this kind of theme. And her work often features kind of ghostly, haunting images. And their spiritual paintings kind of consist of these abstract forms and gestural line work. So next we'll move on to Gallery 4, and we're starting with what is a vitrine. Of course, it's hard to tell here, but it would be the vitrine. We're going to enter the 90s. On this one and then one more gallery. Here we go. The gallery constellates Godzilla Asian American Art Network. And Godzilla formed in 1990 to support the production of critical discourse around Asian American art and increase visibility. It was founded by Ken Chu, Bing Li, and Margo Machida. Godzilla produced exhibitions, publications, and community collaborations that sought to stimulate social change through art and advocacy. Envisioning a lateral and porous network, Godzilla created space for a diasporic Asian artists and art professionals. Godzilla considered anyone who attended their public meetings a voting member. So even if you attended just once, you were part of the group and could vote. Godzilla, started with this core of 16 founders, but the group's membership of artists and art workers would reach over 300 locally and 2,000 worldwide by 1995. Its constituency included individuals from a wide range of Asian Pacific American communities, as well as different genders, ages, generations, classes, and sexuality. For more than a decade, the diasporic group, having grown from this kind of local organization into a nationwide network, confronted institutional racism, Western imperialism, anti-Asian violence, the AIDS crisis, and representations of Asian sexuality and gender, among other urgent issues. The appropriation of Godzilla, King of Monsters, as the group's namesake and logo underscores the artist's uncontainable and irreverent qualities as conjured by the mutant Japanese creature who rose from the nuclear ashes of World War II in the pop film Reckoning with the Imperial Histories of the East and West. And I think we've got some of their letters here. They're kind of sent out newsletters. So going to the wall, so what you were seeing is the vitrine here. This is the wall above it. Godzilla does not have many, if any, collective artworks. So they are mostly just kind of a network of organization. However, we did want to and felt that we could collectively represent the group, you know, as in their activism as artwork. And so we positioned some of their activism as a work of art in this time, which institutional critique and performance art and conceptual art were, you know, kind of becoming dominant art forms. So one example or one decision that we made was to position and include their 1991 letter to the Whitney in the wake of the biennial as an artwork. So we hung it there, a frame. We used the frame to kind of mark it as such. So prompted by the kind of chatter about the lack of diversity in the 1991 Whitney biennial and also the ones previously, for those I'm familiar with the Whitney Biennial. It's a biannual exhibition kind of marked at highlighting the best of in American art. It's almost always critiqued, so this is kind of no different. But, you know, noting the kind of absence of Asian American artists in 1991, Godzilla issued a letter to the museum's director, David Ross, in which the group drew attention to the lack of Asian American representation, both in museum exhibitions and collections, but also on executive boards. It was written by a working group within Godzilla, including and consisting of Byron Kim, Margot Machida, Yong Soon Min, Paul Pfeiffer, and Eugenie Tsai. Eugenie Tsai is a curator, but the other artists are represented in our show. The letter put forward an argument for Asian American representation based on major demographic and cultural shifts in America, and more importantly, forcefully critiqued institutional multiculturalism and its claims of inclusion, thereby bringing this cultural issue into the registrar of political exclusion. And through its extensive grassroots network, so by 1991, right, we were encroaching on that 2,000 member number, Godzilla strategically distributed the Whitney letter to key museum directors and curators throughout the city, Whitney board members, government funders, and the art press to apprise them of the issue. This was a technique that was commonly used by activist groups such as ACT UP to broadcast an action as a public issue. As a result, Ross invited a delegation of Godzilla members to the Whitney to discuss the letter. During the meeting, the group explained the finer points of representation in order to address the institutional lack of knowledge about the value of Asian American cultural production. They argued that the visibility and interpretation of art were limited by a narrow subject position of the curators and museum professionals, to which Ross conceded. The 1993 biennial then, you know, is also known as the kind of multicultural biennial, included Byron Kim, who is one of the working group members on the letter, in the exhibition. And he's represented in this gallery here, which we'll move to. So following the biennial debut in New York City, the 1993 Whitney Biennial traveled to the National Museum of Contemporary Art in Seoul. This was the only time that the exhibition traveled internationally. So on the occasion of the Korean installment, the Korean Friends of the 1993 Whitney Biennial produced a benefit portfolio of artists that included Byron Kim, Merce Cunningham, Nanjun Paik, Lorna Simpson, among others, many of whom were kind of included in the New York edition of the biennial. I think what's interesting is that the piece that Byron Kim included in the Seoul edition was different. For this one, he used different shades of celadon green in his monochrome paintings to reference the glazes in traditional Korean ceramics. So going throughout this gallery, the exhibition continues to include artists engaging in ideas of institutional critique, diaspora, and performance. Institutional critique is a form of conceptual art that involves analyzing power structures and ideologies that influence the display, circulation, and discussion of art. However, the kind of focus on the local never kind of fully leaves the exhibition. This piece here, Korean Roulette, is one such example. This is by an artist named Sung-ho Choi. It features a rotating fan with blades tipped in bloody gloves that hover over a selection of vegetables and common goods found in Korean grocery stores in the U.S. The sculpture draws on Sung Ho Choi's personal experiences working in similar places as a Korean immigrant living in America. This work also references the high-profile confrontations between Korean shopkeepers and black communities in the 1990s, particularly in Los Angeles and New York. The work intends to kind of highlight the racial ruptures that can occur alongside the aspirational gamble of the American dream. So we will now enter the final gallery, Gallery 5, which continues to focus on the 1990s. The work here is featured. It's called Self-Portrait, Hairy Pipe. And this work for us really encapsulated all the themes tethered throughout and became emblematic of the exhibition. It's the one that's featured on the website, for example. So as refuge of the Vietnam War in the United States, Han Ti Pham is a trailblazing artist whose photographic installations and performances confront racism, colonialism, displacement, and identity. In the 1980s and 1990s, Pham's work vigorously critiqued identitarian constructs of sexuality, ancestry, biological gender, and class, dismantling the naturalized myth of a fixed, monolithic identity, which was really key to our understandings of what Asian American art is. Her work, Self-Portrait, Hairy Pipe, depicts Pham dressed in a white shirt with a long black hair and a pipe to her lip. The pipe, which has traditionally been a masculine symbol of Western investigative inquiry and artistic conceptualization, and is even referenced in things like surrealism, interprets and destabilizes the signification and Orientalist reception of Vietnamese women as seamless fetish objects. So this gallery, also highlights Patty Chang alongside another one of Hong Ti Pham's works here. Patty Chang is an artist known for her use of performance, video, installation, and other narrative forms to examine identity, gender, the body, and impacted subjectivities. In memory of her aunt's death from breast cancer, Melon at a Loss, which is the work that's featured over here, it features Chang performing an imagined ritual of mourning in which the artist cuts and eats a melon affixed to her chest while balancing a plate on her head. We'll now go here. So Iranian artist Shirin Nishat is also featured in this gallery. Nishat was affiliated with Godzilla and exhibited at Minor Injury, which was Mobok's gallery. The brochure for this exhibition was featured in Gallery 4, and Mobok is featured in Gallery 3. So there's kind of these synchronicities throughout the exhibition. Created between 1993 and 1997, Shirin Nishat's Woman of Allah series emerged after her return to Iran following years of exile during and after the Iranian Revolution of 1979. The series that is presented here presents conceptual narratives about female warriors during the revolution. I'm going to go on here. I'm going to focus on this one. So here we see another one of David Diao's works. So some of these artists, including David Diao, will pop up many times throughout the exhibition. Nina, who's in our audience here, she has a couple works that pop up as well. So there's some artists that we include more than once for kind of a continuity. So here we see another one of David Diao's works. It's alongside those of Ken Chu and Martin Wong. Diao extends his critique from Odd Man Out to address history and personal experience in Imperial, which is here. The title is rendered in kind of faux calligraphic strokes, a la the kind of chop suey font, on a yellow-black backdrop, powerfully situating the painting within the social context of appropriation, discrimination, and institutional exclusion that continues to mold Asian American artistic experiences. So now we're going to highlight this one here. This is a piece by Mariko Mori. This piece, interestingly, and why I'm bringing it up, one of the reasons is it served as the color inspiration for the graphics in our show, which I think is something fun to think about, a fun detail for you. So in her film, The Shaman Priestess Prayer, Mariko Mori appears as an extraterrestrial shaman cyborg adorned in a white iridescent costume that mirrors her reflective ice blue eyes, symbolizing a bridge between earthly existence and the spiritual cosmos. The film was shot in Japan's then architecturally futuristic Kansai International Airport in 1996. I must say that at the time, this work was really like high tech, and now it reads as totally 90s, which is very fun. The soundtrack, which has now come to play over and over in my head, but features a spiritual chant translated as "The world is melting, the world is melting, becoming one." Mori's photography and performance work in the 1990s featured digital dreamscapes and Buddhist iconography, rendered in mystical and techno-optimistic gloss. Her art, which tends to how ethno-geographical formations of Asia interface with technology, gender, and cosmology, contributes to the complex discourses on Asian futurism and Asiatic femininity. We see it again over here from a different piece. This is a piece by... here by Sasha Sikander. So lastly, and to conclude our inconclusive virtual gallery tour, our interior tour, well, we're going to end here with this work by Nikki S. Lee. So through performance and photography, Nikki S. Lee's work examines the constructed nature of identity, and she's someone we really wanted to include in this show. We felt her work really encapsulated what the show was about. So in Projects, which is a series from 1997 to 2001, which she created during her graduate studies at NYU, Lee immersed herself in a range of American subcultures and social groups: punks, tourists, lesbians, club kids, drag queens, senior citizens. She adopted their attire, makeup, gestures, and body language for extended periods, and then she documented her transformation in situ with compact autofocus cameras. So in the Ohio Project, which is featured here, and is not New York, we know, but she was a part of New York's culture, Lee integrates into a blue-collar Midwestern household. She's surrounded by processed snacks, pleated lace curtains, and a Confederate flag. By fluidly kind of transitioning her appearance, role, and demeanor, Lee questions essentialist assumptions undergirding discourses on assimilation, appropriation, identity, race, and social behavior. So, and finally, I'm going to take us outside of 80 Washington Square East to the sidewalk, where we can see a window here that features a commissioned installation by Shuli Chang at Washington Square Windows. This piece here is part of our exhibition and coincides with the 30th anniversary of Shuli Chang's groundbreaking film, Fresh Kill, from 1994. The work here is titled Shireen Lightfoot. This experimental film speculates a post-apocalyptic New York City in which the lesbian, or this is Fresh Kill, right, in which the lesbian protagonists navigate existential eco-horror, consumer society, urban class drama, and technological dystopia. Described as an eco-cybernoia, an avant-anarcho-eco-satire, the film features a screenplay by Jessica Hagedorn and music by Vernon Reed. The new street-level installation, Shireen Lightfoot, spotlights an iconic neon sign from the film that alternates between the words kiss, kiss, and kill, kill, and a sprawling assemblage of televisions showing static noise. The image of the film character Shireen Lightfoot leaps over a techno junkyard wreckage as the techno junkyard wreckage kind of looms in the background. So that is what I have for you all, and I invite you to come to the exhibition and see it in person at 80 Washington Square East. The address is conveniently the name of the gallery, 80 Washington Square East. It's open from Monday to Saturday from 12 to 6. I've got some gallery hours next week as well that I can share with you. It's on view until next Friday. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much for the talk, by the way. This was great. It's really wonderful to see the exhibition this way. I noticed you had an Iranian artist.
Yeah.
And I noticed like all the artists were primarily East Asian. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if that was a lot of the sort of expand the idea of what Asian American is, mm-hmm, happened after the end of the period that you were looking at.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if that was part of your conversation when you're putting this together.
Yeah.
What were some of the things you have talked about?
Yeah, so the question for those maybe that is questioning the inclusion of Shirin Nishat, and I don't even know if we can go back to this, and thinking about this idea of Asian American identity more broadly, right? So beyond just East Asia to include kind of West Asia as well. And she's an artist that was included kind of as a nod to that. And you're correct, most of the artists that we show in this exhibition were of East Asian descent, in part that was because the organizations that we constellated, that was the demographic associated with that. And that was sometimes something that the exhibition or that the groups, including people like Godzilla, they were very cognizant of and aware. And Godzilla especially, and that was a group that was working into the 90s and kind of towards like a broader understanding, were aware of this kind of, you know, lack of representation and tried to work towards it or to fix it. So our kind of inclusion of Shirin Nishat was kind of a nod to that discussion. We didn't necessarily want to present something that wasn't a reality, that was something that was lacking for these artists' understanding of Asian American identity in that time period. But we also wanted to acknowledge that that was a conversation that these artists were having. Shirin Nishat was a really good choice for us because she was a part of these networks and she was living in New York. So she was a natural kind of selection for us to kind of reflect on that as well. But that broader conversation of even what is Asia and what is Asian American, is it predominantly, or how do you represent that historically and how do you represent that today where it's very different? That's something that we talked about a lot. So,
I have a question regarding the aesthetic questions, because you're talking about these artists who are either born here or else they're migrating. Mm-hmm. Cultures. But in New York, in targeting New York City, this is one of the key cities globally for the training of artists in mm-hmm. terms of curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
There's art history, there's the studios, there's the critical factors. And I'm wondering if, just looking at the examples of how many of these artists were actually resisting, as you were talking about, mm-hmm. the ethnographic domination or colonization of westernization and modernism,
mm-hmm.
and how conscious were they in terms of hanging on to or doing research with their ethnographic roots, which mm-hmm. were from another country, and whether we are actually still involved with these problems. I used to teach at Pratt and Cooper. Mm-hmm. And when I was a student, I had professors who were, well, I'm going to just mention that these women students told me at Cooper that they experienced misogyny by white male professors,
mm-hmm.
and that one time this student who was Chinese had a picture of Bruce Lee on the wall, and this white male professor walked in and actually said, "Who put that up there and tore it down?"
Mm.
And this was like maybe 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And now with the political situation, whether we're still forced into either the modes of modernism, postmodernism, or some sort of white Christian nationalism.
I'm sorry to hear about that happened, or that you were witness to those experiences at Pratt. I think there's a number of different ways that we can answer this question. So the question is kind of, are these artists actually resisting something? You know, or how do they engage with their past? And I think it's an individual response, right? So each artist is kind of different. We have artists that were born here, some artists that were migrating here. I think I've got two tenets in my head that I'm like thinking about how I could maybe start to answer this. So the one thing is, going back to Gallery One, so with Basement Workshop, we were presenting the kind of posters as an artwork. That was a radical, in the way that gallery is kind of divided. There's artists that are engaging with the art world and creating work in that language. And then there's the artists that were creating work on the community level that did reference their past. For example, the Basement Workshop posters, that's kind of a direct you know, there's a direct connection to kind of Chinese woodblock print tradition and propaganda poster aesthetics. Many of the artists were Marxists as well. So there's kind of connections there that the artists were negotiating with. In terms of kind of unconventional art forms, I think now looking back at art history, we see these kind of trends throughout, such as institutional critique, right? So something like the Whitney letter that we're kind of arguing is institutional critique. That wasn't mainstream then, so that was against the grain. And now we kind of understand that that's kind of part of art history, but that wasn't necessarily the intention. I think that's how I would answer that to start.
I think because I worked with all the three groups, there were so many overlaps. And as many of you know, Shireen worked and helped start Storefront for Art and Architecture. She was married to Jeff Park. Many of us thought of ourselves as community-based artists because we were free from the commercialization. There was that label to deal with. So, you know, you get the backlash, you get this kind of labeling of this, you know, activism, but, you know, we weren't really trying to be activists. I think we were just soulful in getting, you know, the kind of raw and I think justification of how art, you know, really served what we were trained to be, or we, you know, felt in our, you know, kind of like journey and passion, and knowing that Epoxy and all the other groups, you know, we could step in and out and be active, teaching workshops, you know, doing the silk screens or doing all kinds of portfolios, and people didn't really get to see them because, you know, they you know, I guess we were the marginal, but we were actually freer and having Ira Way come. I mean, you know, that a lot of it was the language problems and the comfort zone of having different camaraderie. So that was really kind of promise.
Thanks so much, Nina. That's really special. Yeah, Nina has three lovely pieces in our show. We had one back there.
Online question. Has anyone of the artists visited or given feedback to the where will it go next after?
Oh, that's a great question. Yes, many of the artists have, not only have come and visited many times, and most of them were along for the ride well before this became even something that we applied to. So the artists have been really receptive and really gracious and really kind. And so we are, you know, that's what you want. And so we were really happy that we could offer this kind of show to these artists that we've been working with for a long time. At our opening, it was packed, and a lot of the people that were there were the artists and their families. Many of these works hadn't been shown for years, so it was really special to be able to offer a, like, you know, full opening, you know, big opening, kind of with the attendance spilling out. And that was really special. Where it will go from here, we're working on a catalog for the show. I don't have any public details right now, unfortunately, but we are working on it, a post-mortem catalog to accompany this. We have also been in conversation with the curators of the appearance team, which is at the exhibition at the America Society, relating to Asian diasporic art in South America, and we're hoping to put together an informal kind of chapbook type of publication that's resulting from our conversations with them. So that's what's next. This show, I don't know if it will travel or not. To some extent, there's something special about the collection of artists and what kind of came from it that we are curious if it can be replicated or if there would be a whole new roster of artists or what would happen. So for now, the focus is on the catalog.
Thanks for that wonderful presentation. So the exhibit Legacies is available to visit, as Professor Souther said, until Friday, December 20th. There's a link to it on our website also if you can't find the announcement yourself. So enjoy the rest of your Friday evening. Happy holidays, and we look forward to seeing you at ARI again.